Welcome to the Remote Teacher Podcast. We're excited to have you here. I'm Heike Hustler, an experienced regional, rural and remote teacher, author of children's, middle and YA books and co-creator of the Facebook group Teachers in Remote Communities, Past, Present and Future, along with Carl Merrison and Lynette Gordon, and the co-owner of website The Remote Teacher. The Remote Teacher Podcast and all our support platforms come from a passion to improve the experience of remote teachers and in turn create positive outcomes for our remote students and communities. You can find out more about us on www.theremoteteacher.com.au, over on our Facebook group, Teachers in Remote Communities, Past, Present and Future, and of course by listening to this podcast. Now remember, you can also download these podcasts so you don't need internet access and you can listen to them wherever you need, including on your long drives out to your remote and rural communities. Please remember to like us on Facebook, on Instagram, and by signing up to our email list. And before I introduce our guest for today, it's important to acknowledge that the discussions that we have here are the opinion of the guest and myself alone and do not represent anyone, including Department of Education or any particular organisation, unless, of course, they've come on stating that they're representing that organisation. It's also important to consider First Nation peoples, communities, students and families are all diverse and unique, and what works for our guest and myself may or may not work for you, your students, your families, your communities and your schools. So take what you need, leave what you don't, sit back and enjoy. Let's begin.
Happy to welcome Anne Adams, but before we begin our discussion today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians on the lands we meet, the Bundjalung people of Northern Rivers, New South Wales, and the Larrakia people where Anne is for her holidays and this interview today. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to any First Nations peoples listening along with our podcast today. Welcome, Anne.
Pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging of the Yawara language group, the land on which I teach, live and whose children I work with and whose community I serve.
Wonderful. Thank you. Do you want to share a little bit about your background prior to going out to work remote?
My background prior to going out to work remote is quite convoluted. I started off with a psych degree. I worked in alcohol and drug counselling. Then I worked as a youth worker to homeless youth in Melbourne. And then I went to Japan with my partner and we ran out of money and I started teaching English and fell in love with it. Absolutely fell in love with it. Of course, we were teaching English as a foreign language, and that means that the people you're teaching are not immersed in a culture that speaks English. And I was teaching adults. So after several years, we came back to Australia and I started teaching and became the director of an English language college in Melbourne. And then life changes and I had a child and I became a single parent. And I got my teaching degree, because up to that stage I didn't have any teaching qualifications. Got my teaching degree and I moved into high school. And the next 25 years I spent teaching English, teaching Japanese, teaching EALD and teaching history. And I wound up in a wonderful job in a senior secondary college and I loved it. But things had changed again. And my daughter was in London. And I was sitting in a suburb of Melbourne and had been in the same house for 30 years and went, what am I doing here? I could be anywhere in the world. So where do I want to go? And after thinking about going overseas again, you know, teaching English in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, China, I decided that I actually wanted to go remote. And it took about another 18 months before I managed to organise everything and went remote, and that was 7.5 years ago.
What a wealth of experience and knowledge you were before coming remote. I imagine that your experiences working in psychology and youth work have really served you well when you went out to a remote community as well.
Why I went into psychology and youth work is because I, I love kids, and I'm passionate about them having confidence in themselves. And that's where I want to make a difference. I want children and their families to actually have pride in who they are. And it doesn't matter whether it's a child in a leafy suburb of Melbourne, or it's a child on the streets, or it's one of my students. That's my passion. I want them to leave feeling better about themselves than when they came in. What I'm about.
Your background in EALD and working in all those different countries and teaching English as a foreign language, then you transferred that knowledge into your remote context. So I wonder, what strengths do English as a second language or dialect students bring to the table, this idea of being multilingual?
I want to actually go back a bit.
Sure.
And I want to go back to my first experience in remote. I came in as a high school teacher, and they don't really exist in remote. I mean, you have the classes from kinder through to year 12, but in all the remote schools, it's rare to actually have a high school as I know it. I'm still teaching primary, so I had a lot to learn. I never taught reading before. I taught English as a subject and EALD, but my kids could all read. So I had to go back and do a lot of learning on how to teach reading, how to teach maths, all sorts of stuff. But my first school, I was told that kids were learning English. They spoke English. They needed some help. And I started listening to them, and they weren't speaking English. They weren't speaking standard Australian English. So there's no such language as English, right? It's an umbrella term for all different dialects. And we, as a person from Melbourne, I speak standard Australian English. But the kids were not speaking standard Australian English. They were speaking something else, and I didn't know what else it was. But I started listening, and it was obvious that it was embedded in an English that was a long time ago, because they say things like murka instead of car, right? And it had its own grammar rules. It had its own language. It had its own referencing. And I asked around. People told me I was stupid, you know, that they speak English. What are you talking about? And I made some terrible mistakes with my ATs because I just assumed that what I was being told was correct, that they were speaking English. So I corrected some stuff, and they were horrified that they were making mistakes, because they didn't know that they were speaking a different language. And that's when you teach in remote, you're teaching children who are actually speaking a different language to you. Some of the things sound alike, but don't be too confident about it. You know, things that you say and things that they say can have completely different meanings. And I have troubles listening to my friends who speak Aboriginal English, because they don't have many markers for time, and they don't have many markers for who or what they're speaking about. English has a million markers. We're used as a business language because everybody's very clear about what they're speaking about, because we have those time markers and those referencing markers. But a lot of other languages don't, and Aboriginal English doesn't, that I know of. I don't know it well enough. So the first thing that they bring to the table is that they're speaking, they come in wanting to learn. And I think the greatest strength is all children want to learn. And if you come from that premise, then things start unfolding. You start understanding what's stopping them from learning. All children want to learn. They come and they may not be speaking the language you're speaking. So everything you say, everything you do, you need to actually pre-teach. So it's not an assumption that they actually know. They're good at guessing. They're really good at working it out, but they really need to be taught. One of the things that we do, like if I hold up a picture of a chair, and listen to how I'm describing it, a chair. If I hold up a picture of a chair, I get them to chorus chair. I mean, it's very simplistic. But we never use chair as a word. We always use a chair, your chair, my chair. It's always prefixed with one of those pronouns or counters or whatever. And we need to be teaching that from the very, so that we're modeling language. But the other thing our students need to know is that they're learning a different language. It's not the same language. Yes. So the very first thing I do when I'm with kids is, all right, so you speak Aboriginal English, you might also speak another, and I speak standard Australian English. Let's have a look at some of the differences, you know? So if I go to the shop, bingo shop, you know, it's, I put on my, can you put your seatbelt on? Seatbelt, put them, you know? And we start seeing that there's differences and they start understanding that it's a different language. It's a good language. So we start moving between the languages. So they know that they're actually learning a different language. Because what happens is kids come in, you speak, they don't understand you. They think they're bad because they can't understand you. They think that it's something to do with them. And you have thoughts about why can't they understand? And when you realize it's the filter that it's the same language, you're putting everything and they're putting everything that they're all speaking the same language and it's untrue.
Mm.
So ELT is fascinating.
And then the work you do on the code switching once they understand that they are speaking Aboriginal yes. English or Creole and you're speaking Standard Australian and the places that you can use both or, you know, switch between both.
Yes, I think it's really important. Creole at least has a name that is recognised and kids often know that they speak Creole. But Aboriginal English is how do I survive until my 60s before I've even heard about that language?
Yes.
No, but it's a miracle of a language. When you think about it, it started as a language between non-Indigenous and Indigenous, but it spread to a language between different people from different countries, Indigenous people from different countries. So people in Perth can speak to people in Alice Springs. That never used to be the case. So it's actually a remarkable language that has grown up in the past 100 years, but it's not recognised.
Yeah,
and there's a whole heap of, it's not just language comes with culture. So you can learn a language, but you need to understand the culture of it. And one of the things, Diana Eads has written a book called Aboriginal Uses of English. She's written a number of books. I think she's a professor. And I was teaching, I was doing a lot of PD with my staff last year about Aboriginal English. And I read one of her books and it was eye-opening because...
Even for you.
Oh, yeah, because it was about the culture, Aboriginal culture and how they used Aboriginal English. And one of the things that she said, and I can't remember the word, inquisitorial maybe, is that English... You ask questions in English. So English is you ask questions, right? We ask questions all the time. You start off asking me questions. How do we interview? We ask questions. How do we get to know people? We ask questions. In Aboriginal culture, and I don't know how widespread, she was only talking about one area in Queensland, but it's definitely been my experience in other areas, that Aboriginal culture doesn't ask questions. So when I talk to my assistant teachers who may be Aboriginal and I ask, what do you think about the arrangement of the room? They'll go, oh, I don't know. And the effect is that they don't have an opinion about it. Maybe even they don't know what I'm talking about, but they do. It's just that they can't. I'm asking a question. So she was saying that the best way is to actually give, I like the room like this. And then they'll say, oh, I think the chairs should be moved over there. So there are opinions there. My AT at the present time, my head assistant teacher, she has strong opinions, but it takes a while. I can't stop asking questions. Yeah, it's just such a natural part of my culture. But when I stop and I put it in another context, she'll have an opinion. Often I've asked the question, I've gone, And she'll come back later and give me the opinion, because she's dealing with that culture, that two-way culture as well. Diana Eades said the problem is in our judicial system. So it's based on questions and answering questions. And wow. Aboriginal people don't do that.
Wow.
And that just blows my mind, the impact and the sad impact of that.
Wow.
And I can see it in my ear. It's, I don't know what to do about that. But we can definitely teach our students to ask and answer questions in our culture.
Yes.
So it's, when we put it in context, this is the Western way of doing it, as opposed to the Aboriginal way of doing it. And we can teach them and they can become comfortable with it, but it needs to be taught. It needs to be.
So we're empowering our students two-way to be able to live and learn in both cultures. But also a really important and interesting thing you highlight about the way we interact with our First Nations staff as well, and reframing our thinking, because I haven't actually spent time thinking about that idea of question asking versus other ways to share and elicit knowledge. That's very interesting to reflect on.
I know yarning is a big part of many Aboriginal nations' culture, but I don't really know how that works, you know, because it's so different to my own culture.
Yes.
I can only sort of meet in the middle a little bit.
And we've both spent a lot of time in remote communities, 7.5 years, I think you said, and yet we're still learning and still thinking and still these big, light bulb moments, which force us to go back and rethink our own practice and our own interactions.
Yes. Mm. Yes. And also acknowledge that we'll make mistakes, so that when we're speaking with our First Nations assistant teachers or teachers or community, you know, to be easy on yourself, but also be aware of what's going on, you know, and then you can meet in the middle.
Just a short break to share books and resources by Hake Your Hustler and Carl Merrison. The Children's Book Council of Australia Book Week on a book in 2019, Black Cockatoo, is a middle reader short novella set on Jaru country. While short, there are many jumping off points to explore. Tracks of the Missing is a WA Premier Book Award, Daisy Atamara Award shortlisted YA suspense thriller. Set in outback Australia, it follows Declan Archer in his race to find a missing busload of students. My Deadly Boots is a First Nations picture book about confidence, identity, and connection. Carl and Hakia also have many more books out across the next few years, perfect for remote classrooms. Full teaching packs are available over on the website carlandhakia.com.au. We also create remote teacher resources, Getting to Know You, Two-Way Learning, NAIDOC, and much more over on our TPT store. So let's get back to this deadly interview.
The other thing that I get very upset at is please and thank you. Please, English is the please and thank you language. We have to say please and thank you all the time. In fact, we have a whole heap of greetings. And I don't know how many times I've stood and kids are to be given, please, thank you, you know, the... And comments by teachers and other people, kids are so rude. Yeah, kids are so rude. But English is please and thank you language.
Yes.
So we have to put it in context that we're teaching two ways. So Western way is saying, Western Anglo-Saxon English way is saying please and thank you.
Yes.
It's not necessarily the Aboriginal way. It's not necessarily the French way.
Yes.
We're used to saying please and thank you. We're used to having greetings. I was with my assistant teacher who is Walpri, and he's now a close friend. And he jumped out of the car and started talking to a person. I just said, you never said good morning or how are you? And he stopped and he looked at me. And we often had these conversations. So he was used to me, you know. He went, I don't have to. He said his family. He lives in this community. I know who he is. I know our relationship. It doesn't change unless he's been away for a long time. And I went, that is interesting. So I had to talk to my daughter and went, you know, I say good morning to you. Am I having to reassert our relationship? Or or actually represents our relationship when I think about English culture. Families split up easily, they do other things, but it's a different view of family, that the understanding of that I don't need to do those things, because it's not that I don't need to, it's that we are all one family. And I just get blown away by that context, whereas in my family, I have to have those introductions. Reassert our...
Well, even some of them are not even kind of important. So you say, how are you? And everyone automatically says, good. There's no depth to that communication or that relationship building in that context.
But I expect it from you.
I expect you
to ask that.
Yes.
Because if you don't ask that, you're being rude. It's really, I'm fascinated.
And in regards to that showing respect, the idea of showing respect in First Nations cultures is often different too, and often through facial expressions and body language that we as teachers from other areas might not be aware of, and yet it impacts our teaching and our interactions with students without our knowledge, perhaps.
Yes. Now, look at me.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, which is...
And if you're having a bad day and you're walking around, you know, with your bunched up shoulders, or you're feeling it, even though you're saying nice things to your students, they're picking up on this other layer of communication as well.
Yes, because they also have to, because they don't understand you. So they're very attuned to what's happening.
Good point.
It's also also English speaking kids in mainstream are often very much more attuned to their teacher than teachers think, because they're watching them. Knowing how a student who was pain in the butt, really, back row boy, you know, can I say that, stood up one day and said, Miss Adams, we don't know who we're getting. Every day you're different. And I walked out and I went, oh my God, what's going on? I went to the doctors and there was something easily fixed, but I had a hormone imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, the class had picked up on it. And I had no idea. I just thought I was being moody.
Yeah. And those things to be aware of in our teaching, especially not necessarily, we could have those underlying conditions as well. But, you know, sometimes you're homesick, you're feeling isolated, you're, you know, having all these, your family's sick back home and you can't get to them. You're having all this stuff going on behind the scenes, and yet you're turning up to teach, and the impact that some of those things can have on our teaching and our moods.
And it's sometimes worth being honest with the kids.
Yes.
So you're being authentic with them, that, okay, I'm not feeling well today, or this has happened. And it makes you human. It makes you not a perfect model of knowledge or whatever. The kid, it just has you relate to them, you know, they understand. Kids are fantastic.
They are. In regards to EALD,
yes,
because this is your specialty and I'm excited to hear, how is teaching an EALD student different than teaching a native speaker? So I know a lot of the people listening might be coming from a prac or some teaching experience, or maybe years of teaching experience in a mainstream school. What do they need to be thinking about when teaching an EALD student?
So I think there's two things. First of all, we say teach English. That has a completely different meaning in mainstream. So when I'm teaching English in high school, or I'm teaching about characters, I'm teaching about understanding the narrative, I might be teaching some grammar, but all the kids can use the grammar. I'm teaching about the meta language, how to name it. And there's nothing wrong with that. We expect our students to read, so understanding the text is very important. But for teaching EALD, I have to look at what language I'm teaching science. I can't think, light refraction or something. I have to think about not only the nouns I'm going to use, I have to think about the tenses I'm going to use. All right, so we're teaching about light, so is it present tense? Light refracts, it is refracting. When we're writing up the experiment, it's past tense. What am I going to concentrate on? How am I going to teach that? It can be it can really be a dark hole that you fall down into, but you have to think about your intention of the lesson and what you want the kids to learn. For example, and this is not an EALD example, but this is an example of intention. So we're going to teach history, right? Going to teach history. We'll do a timeline of the event I'm talking about. So I'm doing this in year six and year seven. We're going to do a timeline. Well, the very first thing I'm going to have to teach many of the kids is how to hold a ruler to rule the line. So to do a timeline, the success is they can draw a straight line with a ruler. Then they can divide it into equal segments, which links into fractions. Then they can list in order, chronological order, events. Now, they may have to list events without knowing the actual dates, but they might have to put dates in chronological order, years in chronological order. Can they do that? Then after they've got their timeline up, how do they actually organize it so that they read all of it? What tense are you going to do the timeline in? Timelines are usually in present tense. They might be in past tense, but you've got to make a decision about that. You know, mother dies 1849, mother died 1849. It's your decision. And it's got to be an actual conscious decision, because you've got to have to teach that. Mm-hmm. And have you taught past tense already? And keep that
consistent structure across that teaching.
Right across in how I'm speaking. Tell them that I'm speaking differently, because this is the way we do it when it's written. Because our tenses are quite different. Written and spoken tenses, or if I'm telling a story or just listing events, the tenses are all very different. So to stop and think about it. And most teachers don't have that expertise. And I think that's where you need to work together. If I had my way, I'd have all teachers do a EALD course, a TESOL course of some sort. Even a six-month one would have them start thinking about how they're teaching and what they need to teach, so that the students develop an understanding of language and can use it. At the moment, it's very piecemeal. I've just written a core language map for EALD. We haven't told everyone I'm a principal of a school. I've been principal of two schools, and I'm now principal of Mbladowich in Barkly region in the Northern Territory. And it's in draft form. It hasn't got everything in it, but the idea is if we teach these grammar points and use of before and after, or then, you know, the order of instructions, which is around about grade one, maybe transition grade one, but you have to actually teach it, you know. You've got to think about how you use it.
And of course, thinking about that there'll be these gaps in knowledge too, so that, like you said, piecemeal, many of our students won't have learned that along the way. So sometimes you're making sure at the beginning of a unit or even beginning of a lesson that you are putting these structures out there and this background knowledge that students need, the vocab that they'll need to use in that lesson, so that everyone's on the same page.
That piecemeal approach is really, we have such a turnover of staff. It breaks my heart, really, because I do know that the schools I've been had constant staff had a greater impact on the students, because things aren't changing. And you know what one teacher's taught and what hasn't. How do we get kids in year six who can't rule a line? Never had a protractor, never seen a division sign. And that's just the changeover of staff and the lack of that core skills going through.
Which is what your language map might hopefully help to address, that there'll be the document to refer to, and obviously you'll train up your First Nations colleagues in using and valuing it, and then as the staff turn over, then you'll have that embedded.
That's the idea. And then I discovered that even when I say, okay, we're going to teach past tense or present continuous or whatever, teachers still need to know how to do it. They need to actually understand how to construct a lesson to actually do that. You know, you may have the language lesson at the start of the week repeated through, and then have all your other subjects using that construct, because we're teaching English as a foreign language. They don't go back into a community that speaks English. They might speak English at the store, but probably not. Probably they're not allowed in. Their parents will be dealing with that, but they'll have their cousin as the person on the cashier. They don't have to. the only people that they're speaking English to are us. And even when they go into the big towns, they stay in their own camps.
Yep.
So we have to provide that.
Which really highlights the importance of having these high expectations classrooms too, and yes, knowing our core role as teachers, that we, you know, provide this gateway into two-way learning and code switching, and kind of this key which all of our students should be able to access as, you know, a human right to be able to operate in both worlds.
It's very important, and it's what the parents and communities want too.
Yes,
they want their children to be able to operate in both worlds, mm-hmm, and to understand both worlds, and that's our job.
So thinking about everyone should do a TESOL or an ESLD course, at least a short course or 6 months, like you said. Yeah. But for those people who are listening to this now and about to go remote, what should they be thinking that are kind of the key basic 101s that they can implement from day one to make them a better teacher for these ESLD students?
That's actually a really good question. Where do I start? I probably don't start straight away, but I start by listening to my students, learning about a little bit, and I mean really in the first week or so, learning a little bit about the languages they speak, so that when I go in, I can actually talk about the different, get them to teach me about the different languages. Okay, so this is what I say. What do you say? How do you say it? Most of them can't do it. They don't switch like that. They can sit in the seat, speak standard Australian English to the teacher, turn around and speak Aboriginal English to the kid next door, and then mum comes in, they'll speak in another language. I mean, but they don't have that conscious switching. So that needs to be taught. And they'll have a hard time of it. But once it's taught, they'll get really good at it. I've had grade fives and sixes who were fantastic translators. And when the little kids came up, they go, oh, Annie, they want da-da-da-da-da-da. And I go, oh, yeah, okay, I understand that. So they can be a real ally, but you need to give it time. You need to actually differentiate those languages, name those languages. You can talk about standard Australian English, what a mouthful. you can actually make them shorter. I always call it by Aboriginal English. I usually call it by the town that they're in. Yeah. And they get that straight away.
Yep.
They get that they speak differently. And I think that's the first thing I do. It doesn't matter how old they are. That's the first thing, you know, get the Indigenous, the local families to help you. If you want to teach them, get them to come in and be able to be the translators and learn how to translate with their kids. They love it, you know, because they're learning as well.
Mm.
And then we can all learn together, and it will give the basis to their child. I think that's the first thing.
So I think that's really important, because not only is it forming the relationships outside of the classroom, it's allowing the families and the parents to be those first teachers as well, and to take that knowledge of two-way and code switching back out into their homes and communities.
And I think that's really important, really, really important, because then they start to understand it, because many of them don't know that they don't speak standard Australian English.
Yes.
And that's the first thing, is for them to be proud of having not two languages, but three or four languages, you know?
Yeah. That was part one of our interview with Anne Adams, who specialises and is very passionate, as you could hear, about ESLD and supporting students who are English as a second language. Stay tuned to a future episode where Anne talks about improving attendance. Each podcast episode, we also try and highlight or spotlight or do a shout out for amazing businesses, organisations, groups and services that are working in remote communities. This could be run or owned by First Nations people, or services that regularly are committed to going into remote communities and listening and working with First Nations people. So here is our shout out and spotlight for this episode. The Australian Literacy and Numeracy Foundation believe that all Australians have the right to literacy, because being able to read and write is key to accessing education and employment and to participating fully in society. ALNF was founded in 1999 by Mary Ruth Mendel and Kim Kelly, who are passionate about helping
people in Australia's most marginalised communities gain literacy skills. Mary Ruth is a leading speech-language pathologist specialising in assisting people of all ages with literacy and learning difficulties through her private practice. Kim is a mother of four with a background in business management. So what do ALNF do? They have a range of programs including early language and literacy, refugee action and support, Indigenous first languages, fostering links between first language and English, subtext using art for literacy, literacy packs sent to young people in remote areas to help develop basic literacy skills, share a book, where there are new and pre-loved quality books to communities most in need, the Breakfast Library, an innovative program through ALNF. They've also been developing language apps between first language and standard Australian English. So you can tell through the variety of programs that there are some that would be suitable to engage with ALNF to support your students in remote communities through book packs or their language apps or other ways. So reach out to ALNF to see how they can support you. The link will be in the show notes. You've been listening to the Remote Teacher Podcast, a podcast where we discuss all things remote outback teaching. Make sure you follow us on Facebook, Instagram, join our email list and our Facebook group, Teachers in Remote Communities, Past, Present and Future. Any important links mentioned or businesses or organisations to support your remote teaching that our guest has mentioned today will be in the show notes. So make sure you have a look at them to find out more. And a reminder again that this podcast can be downloaded so you can access it when you do not have internet coverage or reception. So you can listen to it on your long drives between communities in the outback. Thank you for listening. We look forward to seeing you in the next episode of The Remote Teacher.